Welcome to Catastropod. Today I'm here with Mick Ellison. We're in beautiful sunny San Jose for Worldcon 76. Please introduce yourself.
My name is Meg Ellison. I'm a science fiction and horror writer. I live in Oakland, California, and I'm very excited to be on the show.
Okay, so I came across the book of the Unnamed Midwife in an airport, I believe in, perhaps it was 2017. It was perhaps Kansas City.
Oh my God, I was unaware I was in any airports.
Well, I found your book in an airport.
Awesome.
And sort of read the back, thought this is totally my jam, and bought it. And I didn't read it until I got home from my trip. And then when I did, I tore through it. I just, this is so my jam, because obviously, I mean, I host a apocalypse podcast. I've always been a big fan of the apocalypse. So like one of the first questions I like to ask, and I've done an entire podcast about what my gateway drug to the apocalypse was, but is the apocalypse something you've always been interested in? And if so, like, what was your gateway to it?
Those are good questions. So all American kids are, to some extent, raised on a diet of apocalyptic fiction. It just depends on how you look at it.
Mm-hmm.
Particularly those of us who grew up in Christian churches. So I lived for a long time in the South and the Midwest, and the idea of the end times was just always with us. So I grew up really paranoid about the end of the world in some form. And the way they give it to children, or the way they did when I was in Sunday school anyway, made it sound like it was imminent. Like, I would have nightmares about it all the time. So I sort of grew up during that and some of the end of the Cold War and the nuclear scare. So I think I thought about the end of the world more than most children. And it probably made me into a weirdo, but we could point our fingers at anything that made me a weirdo. There's plenty of reasons. But I started to discover apocalyptic fiction because of that. And I think my big gateway drug was probably The Stand by Stephen King.
That's mine too.
It's such a good book.
Episode one of Catastropod is The Stand.
Oh. I must listen to that. The Stand is such an incredible doorstop of a novel. I have to say, the first 4/5 of it are purely brilliant, and I can't stop talking about how great they are, and the last fifth is just garbage. It's garbage on a stick, dipped in garbage, with extra garbage sauce on the side.
Who was I talking to? So basically, once Stew breaks his leg, that's when he stopped reading.
That's it. That's the end. Like, I really love the last interchange between him and Kojak, when they have the, like, adorable man and dog bond. And then past that, there's just nothing redeemable. It's so sad. But the rest of the book is so good, I don't care. I reread it every year.
Wow.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
That's amazing. So it's nice that we have the same gateway drug.
Very helpful.
Yeah,
yes.
Definitely.
We have a shared lexicon of these things.
Yeah. Yeah. So one thing I find really interesting, and it comes to sort of in the forefront of The Stand, is that post-apocalyptic fiction is a journey story.
Mm-hmm.
We're always starting in one place but needing to end up in another for various reasons. Sometimes, like in the book of the Unnamed Midwife, we're not really sure why, but do you enjoy that aspect of the journey?
I do. I think ultimately survivors in a post-apocalyptic novel, particularly mine, are looking for not only safety, because safety can be found anywhere you can be alone, but that ever elusive combination of safety and company that you can stand.
Mm.
There's something that I did in my novel that was very important to me, was to examine the question, what if you found people who were perfectly safe to be around and weren't going to try to eat you or anything, but you also just didn't like them? I just hate when people in post-apocalyptic novels like settle into a cozy little cottage with people they've never met before, and then they very conveniently start making a family and fucking and having Monopoly night, when chances are much more likely, since I've met a lot of people, it is difficult to get along with a lot of them, especially if you live with them. Yeah, I always thought that was highly unlikely. So the road is toward that setup where it finally works. And I just couldn't see that being easy, so I had to keep the midwife on the road for a long time.
Mm. I really enjoy that the title of the series is Road to Nowhere, but it also fills me with a sense of, so obviously, to inform you all, the book is part of the first part of a series called the Road to Nowhere series. The second book is the Book of Edda.
Mm-hmm.
Third book is the Book of
Flora.
Flora, that's right. And it will be out
April 23rd, 2019.
Nice.
I just found out. I'm so excited.
That's wonderful.
Yeah.
The title of the series does give me a bit of a sense that we're not headed anywhere good.
So it's kind of, it's almost a layered pun. So it came from a couple of things. Number one, my publisher told me I needed a name for the series because of the way marketing works at 47 North. So I was thinking about it when I got her email, which I have to confess, I'm sorry, Adrienne, I was in a bar. And I was hearing the song Road to Nowhere by the Talking Heads. which I've always been partial to. I love the Talking Heads, and I was listening to the song and I was thinking about it, and even that song has a certain hopelessness to it. Like, it's quite cheery, but it ultimately surrenders to the idea that life has no point, and, you know, what pop music doesn't, really. But I was thinking about the place in the book, which becomes named Fort Nowhere. It was originally Fort Leonard Wood in southern Missouri, and then they make it over and make it nowhere. But that's sort of a play on the old idea of utopia. So a lot of people know this one, but let me just run you through it and pretend to be very pedantic for a minute. Utopia comes from a Greek word, and there are two different possible meanings for it depending on the vowel you apply. It is either utopos, the good place, or utoplos, which means no place.
Ooh.
So utopia is nowhere.
Oh, I like that.
I always think of that as my little layered joke.
Yeah, very. It's very clever.
Thank you. I try and to be clever.
Mysterious. And obviously, when I think of the title of the series, I think of the song, the Talking Heads song.
Of course.
And now it's going through my head and it'll never stop.
I know.
I'm going to take a moment to let our listeners know that I am not only incredibly tired, I'm incredibly hungover. So I believe my questions are going to be rambling, cool. Perhaps nonsensical.
Cool.
What inspired you to write, not necessarily a feminist apocalypse, but to explore feminism in the apocalypse?
So that was a combination of things. Although the book is, I think, a work of feminist thought, and I am myself a feminist, I try to describe it as a gendered apocalypse, mm-hmm. because it's not just the position of women, it's the question of how we define gender when everything that we base our current gender roles on no longer exists. I was spurred toward that because I have to live the life that I live, where I'm perceived as a woman, and people treat me like a woman, and I am a woman. And that's been a series of revelations that things are worse than I think. And that's been very difficult at times.
Mm.
I became interested in gender and women's studies in college, and I was particularly upset when I started to read post-apocalyptic fiction, and I've read quite a bit of it. I tried to wipe out the canon in English, that the point of view character is always male,
mm-hmm.
and that even when women characters are included, they're very rarely given agency. They usually hang around just long enough to give birth to the child of promise, and then are conveniently dumped in a refrigerator somewhere. I think my favorite example of this is, I think Cormac McCarthy's The Road is a brilliant novel, one of the best things I've ever read. I was utterly wrecked by it for 6 weeks. But he was afraid to have a woman in the novel, so he disposes of her as quickly as he can. There are good examples, of course. I think Frances Goldsmith in The Stand is an excellent example. But when I thought about what works I know in the post-apocalyptic sci-fi genre, where the point of view character is a woman who has full agency, who does not make excuses for a partner who abuses her,
mm-hmm.
which is a problem I ran into in a book with a female novelist, there are so very few. Oh, It's a Gift Upon the Shore.
Okay.
I was so upset at that book. But aside from that, there's P.D. James's Children of Men,
mm-hmm.
and there's Margaret Atwood's The Handmaid's Tale. And there is, of course, the work of Octavia Butler, which cannot be discounted and was an incredible influence on me as well. But aside from that, there was just this huge hole on the shelf where these books should be. I was asking myself, where are these stories from the point of view of women? And most importantly, where are the stories where women in these books have specific needs of which male novelists may not be aware? It just killed me that in none of these stories do I see women looking through pharmacies for birth control. And they never have a concern about menstrual hygiene products, and they never have any different health issues. They, like I said, they'll occasionally very conveniently die in childbirth.
Mm-hmm.
But other than that, you can tell that a man is behind the story.
So one thing that a friend of mine who had read Born by Jeff Vandermeer commented on was the fact that the main character could fuck with abandon. And there's sort of no mention. And in that kind of way, you could sort of tell it was written by a man.
Right.
Because if it was written by a woman, there'd be at least something. There'd be a mention of the fact that she was perhaps infertile, or we used a specific method. That's not a concern because men don't think about that.
They don't. And every woman I know, no matter how sexually free or sexually active she is, never stops thinking about it. So I had a formative moment when I was studying at Berkeley, when I had a wonderful professor of American literature who taught us Hemingway. And there is a character in the novel, The Sun Also Rises, who, you know, like all Hemingway's heroines, is very emasculating. She cuts her hair short and she tells men where to stick it, and she fucks a 19-year-old bullfighter.
Why not?
Why not? You know,
why not?
If you're in Spain. So the thing that drove me nuts about this story was it's the 20s. She's living in Europe. She is fucking with abandon just to make the castrated point of view character feel bad. And I asked the question in class, because Hemingway's main characters are often castrated or impotent in some symbolic or real way. And I asked my instructor whether the character, the woman character, Brent, is meant to be read as infertile, as a parallel to that. And he just sort of blinked at me like an owl. And he was like, what do you mean? I'm like, well, she's fucking every man she can find, including this 19-year-old bullfighter who's basically, like, wearing a sandwich board that says, I am virility. And she never catches pregnant, and she never talks about catching pregnant, and I know that there was no commercially available birth control at that time, so what gives? And he just sort of stared at me. He was in his late 70s. He'd been teaching at Berkeley since long before I was born. And he said, I have no idea. No one's ever asked me that question before.
No one has ever asked me that question.
That drove me insane. I started thinking about the questions that we don't ask, the stories that don't get told, the people who don't get to talk in the book. So I was on fire with this book by the time I graduated.
So obviously, when I post this online, I'm going to include, like, trigger warnings, because obviously it's what I do. I believe that they're essential. So trigger warning, sexual assault. Do you think that the post-apocalyptic genre deals with the fact that women are chattel in the apocalypse? Like, how, what were you trying to do to subvert that, or what were you trying to say about that in the Book of the Unknown Midwife?
Of course. First of all, I wholeheartedly support the idea that your content, if possible, should come with warnings so that people can be gentle with themselves and make decisions about what they'd like to consume. So, hooray for you. Whenever possible, I try to tell people about the book as well. So if you happen to drop by an author's blog, you will know. But my book, of necessity, has to deal with sexual assault, not only because it's a thing that happens in the world now, but also in all of the research that I did about extreme gender parity in places where men outnumber women, the incidences go way up. There's almost, I mean, there are ways to stop it, but it's endemic to that situation. So, in the books where I've read it where I thought it was poorly handled, I think universally my problem was that it is either handled at such a distance that we barely understand what happened. It's clothed in too much metaphor, and it's layered underneath all of these blankets that keep us from seeing it.
Fade to black is
an excellent example. Yeah, no, it's they just want to look anywhere else, but they do want us to know what happened. Or it's frankly eroticized. There are lots of writers who put our faces right up against it, and there is no way to look away, and there are way too many details, and it continues as a sexual act, when in fact sexual assault is the least sexy thing that can happen. And I think it's really apparent when an author doesn't know that. So because I had to include it, I had to think about what it is actually like. And somewhere in the middle of that, somewhere in between being behind a billion veils and being with our faces pressed up against it, is the reality of the indignity and the pain and the drudgery of it. So I tried to treat it as sensitively as I knew how, while also making it crystal clear.
That is one thing that, being a fan of the apocalypse, I mean, it's one thing that I come across again and again and again in film and in literature, is the notion that that women become chattel, women need to attach themselves to men. Without birth control, women become chattel. That was a quote that Barbara Webb said something about at the novel writing workshop. Mm-hmm. I believe I was on the way back when I found your book from the novel writing workshop.
Oh, you were in the perfect frame of mind.
Yeah, and so I found that really interesting. We were talking about the apocalypse for some reason, and she said that quote. And I found that really interesting and sad.
It is sad, and it's also, it's one of those things that I think we don't talk about enough, we don't think about enough. I think most men would be shocked to examine the idea that every adult woman that they've known for their entire lives, if they're alive right now, has been on birth control for most of her life. You are constantly surrounded by this, and you're not even aware of it because no one makes it your problem. I do think that we are not many layers of distance from an existence where women are not much more than chattel, and there are many places in the world where that's fewer layers than it is here. I think that what's different about my book is that the chattel get to speak, and that the women in it don't necessarily have to attach themselves to stronger men in order to survive. Indeed, some of the women who decide to do that don't fare any better than anybody else, because men are as fallible and as killable as any other body. This is really, all of my work is grounded in the horror of the body. It is a horror to be a meat sack.
It really is.
It's difficult.
Especially today, for me.
Being a meat sack is really hard when you're hungover. Mm. But we're vulnerable and disgusting, and we're full of various noisome fluids that we don't always have control over whether they're leaving our bodies. And when you think about that, like, horror is is less than arm's reach away. I mean, you stick a finger in your mouth and you have a horror novel. And there's nowhere for most women that that's more apparent than in the onset of their menstruation or childbirth. You lose all control. You are on this march toward death. You follow a trail of blood toward it. And by the way, please don't mention it to men because they're very squeamish.
They don't like it.
They don't like it.
They like to do the act, mm-hmm. less about the consequences.
Right? Or the preparation.
Of said act.
That's the hard part. Somebody was telling me that there was a trend in American high schools where girls were throwing, like, clean, wrapped, pristine tampons at boys because it would make them run and shriek in horror. There's nothing wrong with it. It's a rod made of cotton.
Right.
But they've so absorbed the idea that it's alien to their experience and inherently disgusting that you could use them as literally a weapon.
Thinking back on my high school experience,
it doesn't seem that far-fetched, right?
To have a tampon fall out of your bag.
It's the worst
was
thing.
The most mortifying experience that could possibly happen.
Now they know you have a vagina. Like, it was like, a secret until now.
Yeah, right.
Or there were Senate meetings where they had to outlaw tampons because people were threatening to pelt them down on the Senate floor when we were arguing over, you know, our basic rights to bodily autonomy, things like that. It's not a gun. You can carry a gun anywhere in this country, but by God, if you bring tampons to the protest.
So I'm thinking of the book, the series as a whole, but really today I'm talking about the first book because I've recently read The Book of Eddard,
mm-hmm.
adored it. It
Thank you.
Wrecked me. Like, it kind of dragged me across something dirty and pointy across the floor. But like, I seek that kind of experience out. So I'm an apocalypse nut. Like, it's going to happen. Gender.
Mm-hmm.
Mm. Whether we're talking about the first book or the second book, there is that whole notion of gender disparity,
mm-hmm.
Gender fucking, that binary of gender and what it means when it bashes up against each other.
Mm.
That's not really a question. What does that spark off in your head?
No, it's okay. I don't believe in binary gender. That's an easy place to start. It's difficult to believe in binary gender living in a place like the San Francisco Bay Area where absolutely no one is straight. And having been very close to trans and non-binary people in my life and going through their journeys with them as much as possible from my point of view has led me to understand that I think way fewer people are as cis and as binary identified as they think they are. I think we internalize a lot of categorization and, frankly, myths about ourselves when we're so young that we don't know how to combat them. So that when people who are even cis-presenting are misgendered, their reactions to it are often quite violent because we're just not equipped to deal with ourselves outside of this very simple categorization scheme. So one of the things I wanted to do the most in the book of The Unnamed Midwife was to examine the way that we define gender through external forces, much more than we do through internal forces. We are who we are, and many of us know that inside ourselves, but many of us were told from the outside. And growing up and becoming yourself is a process of unpacking that and decolonizing that and redefining yourself by your own terms. So all of that was very important to me in writing the book of The Unnamed Midwife, but I have to say, for people who are interested in the entire series, it just gets queerer.
Mm-hmm.
The Book of Eddard is much queerer and much more in an ongoing explosion of the notion of gender. And then the Book of Flora is the queerest thing I've ever written, mm-hmm. and I am extremely proud of that in particular.
I could see it coming, obviously. Sort of, if you read the second book, then hear the name of the third, you know that things are going to get different.
It gets very different. And, you know, in my apocalypse, there's approximately one woman left on Earth for every 10 men. And that is a very difficult fraction to work out. That's a hard ratio. It's not 3-to-1. It's not even like a California gold rush mining town. It is worse than any place most of us have ever been. And people begin to identify themselves along the lines of the sexual marketplace. People start thinking about this state of being a woman as something aspirational. And that changes the way we value gender right off the bat. So I really wanted to dig into the idea of how much being wanted makes you unsafe and how much we value what is rare.
Mm. The thought of that kind of gender disparity is terrifying. It inspires such fear when you stop. When I read the book and stopped and really thought about it, I thought, oh, fuck.
So most of the women I know can think of an example in their lives when they've been in this position where all of a sudden you realize you're the only girl at the party, or you join the military and you're the only woman in your unit, or you're the only woman in your computer science class. And we all know how ugly and predatory and suddenly very unwelcoming that environment can be. And it's much worse to think, what if the whole world is like that? I also did a great deal of research into countries where segregation by gender is commonly practiced and places where sex selective abortion has led to an overall disparity in the population. So I was looking at countries where a preference for male infants has changed the ratio to, say, 2 to 1, China and Pakistan being the easiest ones to track down, either through abortion or infanticide. And it messes up levels on things you wouldn't even think about. It changes the overall literacy level in cities that previously had no issue with literacy, and it drives up all violent crime, not just sexual assault, but armed robbery. And there are sociologists who believe that basic gender parity is a necessary ingredient to any stable society. So once we start messing with that, everything goes awry.
I think that would have been some really interesting and somewhat terrifying research to do.
Oh yeah, there was no part of the research for this book that wasn't awful.
Yeah.
I have a good friend who is a midwife, and I was able to consult with them on much of the book. They're mentioned in the dedication, of course, because their help was indispensable to me. And I asked them once, never do this, by the way, if you know someone who's a nurse midwife, never ask them what's the worst thing you've seen in a delivery room. Never ask for a nurse midwife's worst stories. There are things that they told me that not only did they not make it into the book, but I will never say them out loud.
Wow.
I feel like if I tell someone these stories, I will infect them with some of the worst mental images I've ever had in my life. There is nothing more metal, nothing more hardcore than childbirth.
Amen.
So where I wasn't researching terrible violence, I was researching medical cataclysm. So all of the research for this book, aside from the little bit that I did in civic planning, because I wanted to figure out how you could start a city and keep people from getting cholera, that part was cool. The rest was just an unending horror show.
With Camp Nowhere,
mm-hmm.
Do you feel like it's a utopia?
Utopia is such a slippery word.
It is, isn't it?
There is no such place as utopia for everyone. Margaret Atwood nailed this pretty good in The Handmaid's Tale. She says, better never means better for everybody. And I had to really sit with that and think about my idea of utopia and Mike Pence's idea of utopia. We can't even be neighbors. We're going to end up burning each other's houses down. So there are many people who believe that they live in utopia and they live next door to someone who lives in a dystopia. There are people who live in a dystopia and believe that it's a utopia because it's better than anything they've ever known.
There's an Australian book by a woman called Claire J. Coleman, who's Indigenous, and she says that, basically deals with the notion that, like, Indigenous people in Australia have been living in a dystopia.
Absolutely.
For a very long time.
Absolutely.
So what is one person's utopia is another's dystopia.
Exactly.
It really just depends on where you fall, and that's not something you can really decide, is it?
Not everybody gets what they want or even what they need. There's an American author, Rebecca Roanhorse, who uses mm-hmm. the same principle in her mm-hmm. new book, Trail of Lightning, and as a member of the Indigenous population here in the United States, she says we have already had our apocalypse. We are living in a dystopia now. We have to recontextualize everything in order to build anything that takes us back to what we once were. And I couldn't stop thinking about that. I couldn't stop thinking about, especially living near San Francisco. San Francisco has the most obscene wealth disparity I've ever witnessed with my own eyes. San Francisco is a great place to visit if you want to watch a billionaire step over somebody with a needle in their arm. It's a great place to visit if you want to go to the opera and avoid piles of human shit on the sidewalk. It is a land of contrasts, to say the least. If you want to see utopia and dystopia rubbing noses with one another, it is an excellent city to visit.
I witnessed the most San Francisco conversation in the entire world.
Oh, boy.
And it culminated, when I stopped listening, it culminated in the, oh, you haven't been to Palestine.
What?
You must go.
Wow.
So, right? So it was just, it's very San Francisco. That income disparity I've noticed is not just in San Francisco, but in the States
yes.
altogether.
Oh,
I mean,
yes.
It's a really terrifying look at what happens when there is no safety net. poor people.
That's exactly it.
Yeah.
This is the richest country in the world, and it is very easy to fall through the cracks of that into nothingness. I grew up very poor myself, so I often struggle to relate my experiences to almost anyone I know, because I grew up as poor as it is possible to be in a first world country, and many of my friends have no frame of reference for the idea that I grew up food insecure or housing insecure or that I ended up homeless as a teenager. They sort of try to tell me stories about summer camp, and it doesn't exactly line up. And it's that disparity that's at the root of it. Not only do we live shoulder to shoulder with people who are in another universe from us, but also we very rarely hear from another perspective on that. Rich kids don't read poor kids' stories unless they're, you know, Mark Twain, and it all ends up in the end. And by the way, you're secretly very rich, and we're going to rescue you from this life. And that's not how it goes. How it goes is you get sick, and you have no health insurance, and things just get worse from there.
Right. End up missing teeth.
And, oh, yeah.
Yeah. And yeah.
Sorry, you can't hear that, but I'm showing off my poor kid dentistry, which is to say I have no molars on the bottom right side of my mouth.
I guess back to the apocalypse, even though, see, for me, it was a big toss-up between doing post-apocalyptic or apocalyptic, or even pre-apocalyptic, mm-hmm. and dystopia, because I'm fascinated with both of them. But I think they're inherently related. Like,
oh, definitely, yeah.
So what perhaps somebody would call dystopian, I would sometimes think of as pre-apocalyptic mm-hmm. or apocalypse adjacent.
Sure, and yeah. There's all kinds of overlaps in this Venn diagram. Like if we were to look at cyberpunk, or if we were to look at some of the science fiction works of the 1980s, that just assumed that the near future would be grim in a different way than it turned out to be. The surveillance state, for example, is a common specter that's invoked, and we ended up getting a surveillance state, but it looks like Mark Zuckerberg's playground, and we're all very happy to inhabit it. So dystopia doesn't always mean the end of the world. Dystopia often means things just got steadily worse so slowly that we didn't realize it.
Mm.
But I would say it's definitely apocalypse adjacent.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that's probably why I'm so obsessed with the both of them.
Right.
I'm kind of sad that the Road to Nowhere series will wrap up with one last book. But at the same time, having written a series, I know what it's like. You kind of like, you love these characters and you love this world, but at the same time you're like, I'm done. I just want to write something different set in a different world. Mm-hmm. Are you at that stage, or are you happy now that it's done to explore a different kind of world?
I am very happy that the series is done and that I'm pleased and content with how it ended up. I'm going to enjoy talking about it, I hope, forever. I was worried that Unnamed Midwife would become very old to me as people continue to ask questions about it, but honestly, I have the best readers on earth, and they ask me insightful questions that make me think about my own work in a way that I never thought about it before. So I am excited for more people to read the end of the story and for people to know more about Flora and to see both more of where the story began and of where it ends.
I'm really excited to see where it ends.
Oh, I can't wait. I agonized over the ending of Flora. I rewrote the third act like 4 times. I began writing it before the election of 2016, which was a terrible day here in the United States, as you're probably aware.
It was a terrible day heard all around the world.
Yeah, it must have been. Yeah, it was the shit heard around the world. But I tore apart what I had previously written because it wasn't right anymore, because the world had turned on its axis more to the left than I expected. And I had to rewrite, and I had to tell a different story than I thought I was telling. So I think I was processing my own grief from that event through this book. So it was its own species of relief to be out of that entire process when this was through. But of course, I am always, like every writer, excited about the new idea much more than the old idea. So I am very happy to be moving on to other worlds. And frankly, the Road to Nowhere series wore on me because it's a grim place.
Mm.
And more than anything, in the last 2 years, I've been examining why I write grim and depressing stories and where that comes from and how I would like to do differently in the future.
I feel that on a deep and visceral level because my view of the future is grim.
Mm-hmm.
Nonetheless, I'm an optimist.
I'm an optimist too.
And like, it's going to be terrible.
It is going to be terrible, but goddammit, we're going to fight through it. We're going to keep living, and there are going to be good moments in that. I thought about my very favorite post-apocalyptic book of all time is a utopian fantasy. It's the book that made me want to move to science fiction, and I thought if that author had not done that powerful act of imagining, I would have had no place to pin my hopes to. And that is the kind of writer I think I would like to be for a little while. I would like to put myself to the much harder task of imagining how things would be if we did better.
Mm.
That is a much bigger job as far as I'm concerned, but I'm excited to do it.
one thing that I think you need to do when you write really grim stuff
mm-hmm.
is to weave it with threads of hope.
Absolutely.
And I could feel the threads of hope because I don't think I would have been able to keep going. Like, do you know what I mean?
I started thinking that when I was writing it. I was like, I have to move them toward some piece of life that they can enjoy, even just the most basic sensual pleasures of finding something that you'd like to eat or getting to curl up with someone that you like and sleep together or thinking about the future that might be better because you planted strawberries and you're going to be around in the spring when they come up. Like, there are moments in post-apocalyptic books that I love for that exact reason. There's little bright spots in the stand when they find each other and they drink cold beer that they've cooled in a stream and they have big barbecues together. Or there's moments in Cormac McCarthy's The Road where they find that bunker that someone's dug in their backyard and it's full of all this canned food and this man sees his child well-fed and fully bathed and sleeping somewhere safe for the only time in his life. And I felt that on such a deep level. I even wrote a Christmas scene into the Book of the Unnamed Midwife mm-hmm. because all of my favorite homesteader narratives from when I was a kid, like Little House on the Prairie, those are the best days. Those people had difficult lives and they survived terrible winters. And sometimes in the middle of winter, you know, you need a jolly fat man to bring you some cake.
Sometimes you do.
You do. You some really do. I need that real bad.
Yeah. Need it right now. Well, because I am so terribly hungover and because I also have a lot of Worldcon stuff to do, I'm going to wrap that up. But thank you so much for talking to me. So thank you, Meg Ellison.
Thank you so much for having me on the program. It's been an honor.
I like to always say at the end of my podcast, pod fucking save us.